So what I intend to talk about is the past, present and future of the mortgage market in Australia. So I think it's useful to recount some of the history of the market to put the current state of where we are into better context and provide a basis for thinking about how the market might evolve in the period ahead. So let me start with a bit of history. So in the 1960s and early 1970s, the Australian financial system was heavily regulated, and there were a number of wide-ranging controls on the mortgage market, including on the interest rates that banks could charge on their loans, directives on the overall quantity of loans banks should make, as well as moral suasion, mostly coming from us, on who they should lend to. These regulatory controls on the banks reduced their capacity to adjust to the changing conditions and imposed a cost disadvantage on them. As a result, they lost market share to the unregulated financial sector, which in those days was primarily the building societies. The bank's share of housing credit was just below 60% in 1976, with much of the rest of the mortgage market being provided by the credit unions and the building societies. So financial deregulation in Australia began slowly in the 1970s before accelerating sharply in the early 1980s. It affected the quantity of credit provided, the price at which it was provided, as well as the structure of the mortgage market. So let me just show you a bit of history here. So back in at the beginning of the graph there, you can see the banks were a bit under 60% of the mortgage market. And then you can see financial deregulation starting in 70s and 80s and a large shift in the share of banks in the mortgage market. So the main developments which affected that were the reduction of what was called the prescribed asset ratio, which was the minimum share of total assets that particularly savings banks were required to invest in government securities. As that was gradually reduced from 70% to 40% over 15 years, savings banks could begin to shift their assets from government securities into housing loans. On the pricing front, the interest rate ceiling on large housing loans was removed in the early 1970s, and then in April 1986, the interest rate ceiling on all new housing loans, which was 13.5% at the time, was removed. So in terms of the structure of the market, which is what's reflected on the graph here, the distinction between savings banks and trading banks was removed in 1989. In the mid-1980s, 15 foreign banks were given licences to operate in the Australian market. However, the foreign banks in the main focused on lending to businesses rather than lending to households, in large part because they didn't have a branch network which would enable them to compete effectively against the local banks. In a few years' time, or a few years down the track, financial innovation, which would have facilitated their ability to compete without a branch network, was on its way. The major change in the market structure, which is reflected here, was a decent number of building societies and some credit unions converted to banks through the 1980s and early 1990s. So it's not necessarily just the banks picking up market share here, it's actually building societies changing themselves into banks, which causes that shift from the green line to the orange line. Becoming a bank allowed those institutions a greater capacity to expand their capital base. More generally, in the first few years after deregulation, though, business lending grew much more quickly than housing lending. The share of business loans in banks' total lending rose from 54% to 62% over this period. In the early 1990s, however, a number of factors contributed to the banking system shifting its focus from lending to business back towards lending to housing. First, as you're probably some of you at least might remember, the banks suffered large losses on their business loan portfolios during the early 90s recession. In contrast, the losses on their housing loans were relatively mild, and that was notwithstanding the fact that the unemployment rate rose to about 11% at the time and the mortgage rates reached as high as 17%. Secondly, demand for credit from the business sector declined as that sector underwent a period of deleveraging. Third, the introduction of the first Basel Capital Accord saw a change in the risk weighting in favour of housing assets for banks. So as a result of those factors, between 1991 and 1995, the share of business loans in banks' total lending fell by 15 percentage points, which is a pretty large amount, to 48%, while the share of housing lending rose by 16 percentage points to 46%. Since then, that trend has continued so that housing loans are actually now more than 50% of banks' assets. That's been reinforced by the continuing strong performance of housing loans and in terms of demand for credit by the shift downward in the nominal interest rate structure as the low inflation environment was achieved and maintained. So after all that history, by the mid-1990s, or currently, the share of housing loans in banks' total lending stands at 58%, while the share of business lending is about 35%. So the next development, which had a material effect on the structure and pricing of the mortgage market, was the rise of the wholesale lenders. So as nominal interest rates came down in the early 1990s, which is seen here at the beginning, mortgage rates declined much more slowly, such that the spreads on banks' housing loans increased. So in 1993, at the beginning of the graph here, the spread between the variable mortgage rate and the cash rate was about 430 basis points. The reduction in inflation and nominal interest rates eroded the bank's funding advantage obtained from interest-free deposits. These factors, together with the lower level of money market rates and the increased stability of money market rates, provided the opportunity for wholesale lenders to enter the market. These new institutions competed aggressively for market share by undercutting banks' mortgage rates and by introducing new mortgage products such as home equity loans, interest-only loans and low-doc loans. So as a result, the wholesale lender's share of housing loan approvals rose quickly from 2% in 1993 to 8% only 3 years later in 1996. So that's the period there on the blue line at the top there. You can see the rise in the wholesale lender's share of housing loan approvals. So the banks didn't take this sitting down. They responded to the increased competition by reducing their spreads such that by 1997, the spread over the cash rate on their indicator lending rates had decreased to about 175 basis points. The ability of the wholesale lenders to compete effectively was considerably enhanced by the growth of the RMBS market, which is what I show on the bottom panel here. This market, the RMBS provided the source of funds to these lenders, which did not, and those lenders did not have the deposit base that the financial institutions, that is the banks, had. The wholesale lenders had no balance sheet, little capital and no branch structure, and hence were low-cost operations with a large degree of flexibility. In a further response to the competition from the wholesale lenders, in the early 2000s, banks began increasing the discount offered on the standard mortgage rate to new borrowers. This enabled the banks to slow the repricing of their loan books because only new or refinancing borrowers benefited from the discounts, whereas if they changed the standard variable rate, then it affected the whole of their loan book. Initially, banks did not publicise those discounts, but since the mid-2000s, they've been quite open about them, and now the vast majority of new borrowers and existing borrowers pay an interest rate that is below the standard variable rate. The discount has grown over time and has spread to most borrowers out there. So currently, the average borrower is receiving a discount of around 60 basis points on the standard variable rate. This discounting saw the spread between the cash rate and the actual mortgage rate paid narrow further over the decade to 2007. Oop. So in 2007 there, you can see the spread reached its low. As I mentioned earlier, the foreign banks had initially focused on the corporate market when they first began business in the mid-1980s, but from the beginning of the 2000s, they have increased their focus on retail banking, including particularly housing lending. Their share of housing loan approvals increased from about 1% in 2000 to a peak of about 15% in 2008. So what we've got here is the share of loan approvals split up by a few different categories. So it's the five largest banks, which is the four majors plus in history St George, the credit unions down in the bottom left, the wholesale lenders, which is the graph I showed you a minute ago in the bottom right, the foreign banks are the purple line, and the other Australian banks, which are the regional banks, are the light blue line in the top right-hand corner. So you can see from the early part of this decade, the large increase in the share of the foreign banks, particularly Bankwest and ING. So two related factors have contributed to the foreign banks' increased market share. First, again, because they were starting off with a small portfolio of mortgages, meant that the foreign banks were able to advertise lower interest rates without adversely affecting the profitability of their back books. Second, the wider acceptance on the part of customers of applying for loans over the internet and the use of the broker network has increased the ability of these banks to reach new borrowers without establishing a costly branch network. So during late 2008 and 2009, as you can see here, though, the foreign bank's market share fell significantly, in large part because of the reduction in lending by Bankwest. So that's happening before Bankwest is taken over by the CBA. That's actually Bankwest winding back its lending quite significantly through late 2008. More generally, the emergence of mortgage brokers who act as intermediaries between lenders and borrowers and make it easier for borrowers to compare the costs and features of different loans has contributed to the increase in competition between lenders in the Australian mortgage market. So mortgage brokers' share of total mortgage settlements at the moment is about one-third of all loans. In my written version of this speak, I talk a little bit about product innovation, which is what you're going to talk about, I think, for most of the next couple of days. We're not going to talk about it much here. But just in passing, let me note that some of this innovation has resulted in an easing in lending standards and an increase in risk for both borrowers and lenders. But its overwhelming effect has been to widen the range of households who can access finance. But notwithstanding that easing in lending standards, fortunately, lending standards in Australia did not loosen nowhere near as much as in some offshore markets. There is very little subprime lending of the form more common in the US, for example, where loans were provided to those with poor credit histories. The non-conforming loan market in Australia, which is the closest we have to subprime, never reached more than 2% of new loans and is currently less than 1% of all loans outstanding. There are almost no non-conforming loans being issued at the moment, with the providers of such loans having exited or gone into a period of extended hibernation. Consistent with this and the stronger underlying economic conditions in Australia, non-performing loans in Australia have remained very low. So let me show you a little bit about that. So what we've got here is non-performing loans as a share of the total loans. It's broken up by for a few countries. So in December 2009, the share was 0.6% in Australia, 60 basis points, well less than 1%, much the same as it was 15 years ago. Compared with other countries, this is a little bit above the 0.4% in Canada and well below the 2.5% to 3% in the UK and Spain, and then 8% and probably still rising in the US is obviously a completely different situation. Moreover, over the last few months, the arrears rate in Australia has tended actually to be relatively stable and maybe even come down a little. As a result, Australian residential mortgage-backed securities have continued to perform very well. Even the holders of the lower-rated tranches of RMBS have not suffered any losses, as the insurance together with the subordination embodied in the RMBS has provided a more than adequate buffer. That is certainly not the case if you're holding a US RMBS. Let me now turn to the effect of the financial crisis on the mortgage market. So it's obviously had a material effect on pricing and structure in the Australian mortgage market, but it has not had a particularly marked impact on the quantity of housing credit provided. Beginning around the middle of 2007, there was a widespread reappraisal of the risks associated with investing in structured credit products. Securitisation suffered severe brand damage as primarily US RMBS incurred significant credit problems as delinquency rates began to rise. Initially, the problems were most evident in the subprime mortgage market in the US, but they have later spread to prime mortgages as well. So the Australian RMBS market was significantly affected, even though lending standards were much better in Australia, and as I said, the RMBS continued to perform very well. Issuance dried up markedly. So this is on the bottom here is the issuance. So you can see the financial crisis is that last big bar in June 2007, and then the issuance just drops right away through the second part of 2007 and 2008. Most of the issuance during late 2008 and the first part of 2009 was purchased by the government through the IOFM. Offshore sieves, which had been large buyers of Australian RMBS prior to the financial crisis, were forced to liquidate their portfolios as they were no longer able to fund themselves. Those sales into the secondary market drove spreads from about 15 basis points pre-crisis to a peak of over 400 basis points in early 2009. So that's that light blue line is our estimate of what the spread in the secondary market for RMBS was. So that very wide secondary market spread of over 400 basis points completely deterred new issuance because you could buy old RMBS a hell of a lot cheaper. The crisis also had a material effect on the funding costs of all providers in the mortgage market. In addition to the effect on RMBS funding that I've just talked about, wholesale and particularly recently retail funding costs have risen relative to the cash rate. And we've published a little bit of work on this recently. We've got a little bit of publicity. In response to the rise in funding costs, all institutions have raised their mortgage rates relative to the cash rate. The average rate on outstanding variable rate housing loans has increased by around 110 basis points relative to the cash rate since mid-2007. This increase relative to the cash rate is below our estimate of the rise in banks' overall funding costs of about 130 to 140 basis points over the period. In contrast, banks' business and personal loans have increased by much more relative to the cash rate and by more than the rise in funding costs. Because the funding costs of the smaller participants in the market have tended to rise by more, their profit margins have been squeezed more and in some cases their capacity to provide new loans has been curtailed. Some participants have been able to remain competitive and profitable only by cross-subsidising their new issuance using the larger spread they are earning on their back book of mortgages. So these mortgages were funded pre-crisis, so that the subsequent upwards repricing of the whole mortgage book has resulted in the older loans now earning a much larger margin. The pressure on funding during the crisis, together with the near closure of the RMBS market, changed the competitive dynamics in the mortgage market. The market share of wholesale lenders, as was on the graph I had a few minutes ago, fell from about 13% in mid-07 to about 2% by early 2009. Several of the large wholesale lenders were acquired by the major banks. The share of housing loan approvals by smaller banks and credit unions and building societies also declined, though not as much. The major banks' combined market share rose from 60% to over 80% over the period. Nevertheless, housing finance has been readily available throughout the crisis period, with housing credit growing at about 8% a year. The larger banks have filled the gap left by the decline of the wholesale lenders, so there has not been a material constraint on the quantity of housing credit available in Australia throughout the crisis. There has, however, been some tightening in lending standards, with banks reducing their maximum LVRs on prime full doc loans from about somewhere a bit over 95% to 90% during 2009. Banks have also raised their interest rate buffers and increased their genuine savings requirements. Finally, let me just talk a bit about the future, to the extent one can. So looking forward, the competitive state of the current market is reflecting the fact that home lending rates have not risen by as much as funding costs. Moreover, the outlook for the smaller lenders has improved since the middle of last year. The securitisation market is starting to recover, with the volume of issuance to non-AOFM investors picking up and secondary market spreads decreasing, which is what I had here a minute ago. You see that the blue bar is getting a little bit bigger down in the bottom right-hand corner, and that light blue line, the secondary market spread, has come right back down, so it's basically sitting where primary issuance is at the moment. Securitisation is once again becoming a more viable funding source for lenders, with spreads on newly issued RMBS around 130 to 135 basis points over bills for non-AFM supported deals. That's a little below our estimated break-even spread of around 160 basis points. But our estimate of the break-even spread, and hence the profitability of the issue, does not take into account different degrees of subordination across issues. So to the extent that the degree of subordination or credit enhancement required by investors is greater than it was previously, the overall profitability of the issue will be lower. That's because a greater share of the security is retained on the book of the issuer or sold at a higher cost to another investor. The cost of long-term and short-term wholesale funding has also decreased since mid-2009, though the cost of deposits remains relatively high. Consistent with this, the smaller lenders' market share has actually risen slightly over recent months, though they are unlikely to return to pre-crisis levels anytime soon. The pre-crisis level of RMBS activity, which these institutions relied on particularly heavily, was supported by demand from offshore SIVs, which just aren't there anymore. As the major banks have increased their lending rates, though, to recoup increased funding costs, and as funding costs for securitisation have fallen, the smaller participants have become increasingly more competitive. While interest rates on mortgages have increased relative to the cash rate, the Reserve Bank is able to take account of those changes in its policy deliberation. So the cash rate determined by the Reserve Bank Board is still the major determinant of the interest rate structure in Australia, including that of mortgage rates. So with the securitisation market showing greater vitality in recent months, the housing loan market, I think, remains contestable. Any widening in margins is likely to attract new competitors to the market, and already the improvement in securitisation has encouraged some of the smaller lenders back into the market and encouraged some brokers to again look to increase their own mortgage lending. So in conclusion, with these developments, the provision of mortgage credit in Australia is likely to continue to be adequate in a competitive marketplace. So let me finish there.
Mr. DeBell, Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. When that report came out that talked about the widening of margins, one of the banks said that was only temporary because the trend towards switching to that more stable, expensive, long-term funding was going to continue for them. Is that your projection as well?
So, as we said in the article, we expect the longer-term costs of wholesale funding will rise as they roll over their back book, and we think that will rise, say, maybe 20-25 basis points over the next few years. But so is the repricing of their loan book as well. So we think, funding costs are going to keep on rising because of that repricing, assuming nothing else changes. But at the same time, the returns on their loan portfolios are also going to keep rising as well. So yes, we agree that funding costs are probably going to keep rising on that part of the book, but there are other things going on the other side of the book at the same time.
Hi, Jeff Rogo, Wall Street Journal. Quick question. You mentioned at the end of your speech about the improvement for smaller lenders to come to the RMBS market. When speaking with the executives of some of those firms, they've mentioned the lower-rated RMBS tranches aren't finding buyers and they're not able to go to the market because of that. Would you agree with their premise that the inability of anyone to buy these lower-rated tranches is a real issue as we go forward in for the key to improvement in this?
Well, I think in part it depends. If you're a bank and a smaller bank, it doesn't make the difference between holding the banks on your book and putting them into an RMBS. So for a smaller bank, that's not so much of an issue because they can just hold it on their books. If you don't have a balance sheet, then which is a wholesale, most wholesale lenders, then it is a bigger issue. If you look at some of the RMBS issues by some of the non-banks over the last few months, so some of them have actually been able to do a deal. So that's not completely true that none of them can sell that. So is it expensive to sell those lower rated tranches? Yes, it is, which is what I meant earlier when I said that our estimate of the break-even cost doesn't take that completely into account. Obviously, if you can't sell it at all, then you've got a problem. But in part, it's a question of price. So some of those, this question of how much are you willing to sell those lower rated tranches for. I wouldn't say it's true that you can't sell them at all because we've seen some deals where that actually has happened. But is it difficult to sell them? Yes. Is it more difficult than it used to be 2 years ago? Certainly. And does that increase the cost for those people relative to other participants? Yes, it does.